This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. You, me, top experts, 28 minutes and a big issue of the day, which this time is Afghanistan. The Taliban are advancing across the country, capturing town after town from the government. But who exactly is backing the Taliban? This week, President Biden told the Afghan people to fight for their country against the advancing Taliban. But ever since his announcement of American troop withdrawal, the Islamist rebels have been advancing. It's all happened faster than anyone predicted. A well-armed and well-trained Afghan army is apparently being outfought by a patchwork insurgency. Since the results will certainly include a refugee crisis and might well mean safe havens for terror groups, this week I want to know who is backing the Taliban and why. Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. Western Allied forces, predominantly American, removed the Taliban from power 20 years ago this autumn. But the Taliban never went away and now are stronger than at any time since 2001. We asked Ali Latifi, a journalist born and currently working in Kabul, to remind us of the history of this unique organisation.
The Taliban really came to be in response to the civil war of the 1990s. That civil war saw different jihadi factions who had fought against the Soviet occupation of the 1980s, who had freed the country from Soviet occupation. Basically, what happened was around 1992, they all started to vie for power. You know, they were supposed to create some kind of a unity government of their own that never took off. And what that civil war led to was, especially in the city of Kabul, a situation where there were rockets flying all over the city because each side was fighting with the other. The forces belonging to these different commanders that later became to be known as warlords, they were also accused of theft, they were accused of abduction, they were accused of rape, they were accused of all kinds of abuses, and some would even say war crimes. So the Taliban came in a reaction to that. They came to the people, you know, they spread throughout the country, starting from the south. Basically, their whole premise was, we're going to deliver you from this civil war. We're going to deliver you from these warlords. So that was really the Taliban's main selling point in the late 90s. After the Taliban came to power, initially, because they were coming in reaction to the civil war, there was a large percentage of the population that welcomed them, that were happy that they were coming because they thought they would deliver them from these warlords. And initially, the Taliban billed it as saying, because of what happened during the civil war, because of the thefts, because of the abductions, because of the rapes, because of this and that, we have to be ultra strict in the beginning. But eventually, things will calm down and life will start to slowly go back to normal. But that didn't happen. So that was in 1996. And then from 1996 all the way to 2001, for the entire five-year rule of the Taliban, they never eased on their restrictions. You know, you couldn't listen to music. You couldn't watch TV. The way sports were played was highly regulated. Girls couldn't go to school. Women, except for doctors, couldn't go to work. And then when the 9/11 attack happened, Bush administration blamed Osama bin Laden and told the Taliban to hand him over. The Taliban at first said, give us proof. The Bush administration didn't do that. Then the Taliban said, then let us sit down and negotiate. The Bush administration didn't approve that either. So in October 2001, the Bush administration started their invasion of Afghanistan. As time went on, all of those promises that the U.S. made didn't come to fruition. And at the same time, the government here was becoming increasingly corrupt. And all of this, along with the corruption and the re-empowering of these warlords that people had feared for so long, gave the Taliban a way back in. Until like 2004, they had been essentially wiped out. But slowly from 2004 and on, they just started to become a force again. And they started taking parts of the country, and they started, you know, getting more people to join them, and they started to have a presence again. And then when the Trump administration came into power, they really wanted to end the war in Afghanistan. They were absolutely determined to do it. And in around 2018, they started the first and only real direct face-to-face negotiations with the Taliban, where U.S. officials sat across from the Taliban, made an agreement that they signed in February 2020 that paved the way for the withdrawal that Biden is now carrying out. The leadership of the Taliban has obviously changed since 1996. And then also the other thing that's changed is since 2011, their political leadership has gone to Doha to act as a political face, as a diplomatic face. They've gone and traveled the world to try and garner goodwill from the neighboring countries, thinking that they will come back to power. And in their mind, they think they'll take over again. So they want the rest of the world, including the West, to accept them. I think the Taliban today feel much more emboldened, because in their mind, they've won the war. They got what they wanted. They got direct negotiations with the United States. Yes, it took them literally 20 years to do it, but they got it. And not only did they get that, they got two consecutive U.S. presidents to agree to a full-on withdrawal of this country. And then when you add to that the fact that they're gaining so much territory, and it's not only districts anymore, it's literal provinces, of course they feel more empowered and more emboldened.
Ali Latifi. They're strong now, but the Taliban would have found it hard to survive that long period out of power without the help of others. So who is supporting the Taliban, and what do those supporters hope to gain in return? Joining me in the briefing room are Laurel Miller, Director of International Crisis Group's Asia Programme, Ashley Jackson from the Centre for the Study of Armed Groups, and Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid, author of Taliban, The Power of Militant Islam in Afghanistan and Beyond. Before we explore which countries and powers are supporting the Taliban, can I ask to what degree they are actually self-sufficient right now? Ashley Jackson.
Right now, I think they have a number of enormously lucrative revenue streams at their disposal. If you would have asked me that question a year, two, even 3 years ago, my answer would have been different. But what we've seen over the past 18 months, 2 years, is them really expanding this extensive taxation system they have. All these checkpoints on the roads, taxation of imports and customs, so that they've captured, you know, the commerce of Afghanistan. And in a way that's eerily like a government, they often issue receipts. It's pretty predictable. It's pretty formulaic. There's a list of sort of customs tariffs for everything from perfume to cigarettes that would cross the border. And so, you know, of course, the biggest income is taxing the opium trade, right? So that's incredibly lucrative. That's long been lucrative, but they've expanded into this quasi-state-like, looking like, behaving like, mimicking a state taxation system. And that's what's really enabled them to generate the revenue and income systems that they have now.
Ahmed Rashid, have they developed any business interests?
Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, the other big source of taxation is mineral development, especially coal and marble, which they're extracting from many parts of Afghanistan, selling to Pakistan, even selling it to China, sending it through Pakistan. So they have business interests, certainly, and the Taliban leaders who are living in Pakistan have developed their own business interests. They're running trucks, haulage, and property, especially. They're buying property in the border regions, in the towns, and they're all preparing for the time when, you know, this war is going to end.
Laurel Miller, weapons procurement by the Taliban, is that something that they do with friendly governments or from arms merchants, or is it largely through capturing equipment?
It's a variety of sources. And just to make one quick point, we're using the term taxation here, but what we really mean is extortion, just to be clear about it. This is not a normal taxation system. It's much more like racketeering enterprise. So Afghanistan is a place that after decades of war is awash in weapons. It's not difficult to get weapons. They also have over time received financial support, not just from this bottom-up extortion, but in a more top-down fashion from foreign sources.
To the extent that there is and has been significant support from elsewhere, let's talk about where that support is coming from and in what form. Should we first talk about Pakistan?
Yes, you do have to talk about Pakistan first on this topic. The most important kind of support that the Taliban has received over the years is safe haven within Pakistan for their leadership. I mean, it's not a secret. It's not even an open secret. It's a well-known fact that the leadership of the Taliban is resident in Pakistan. They are undisturbed in their residency in Pakistan. Their families are there. They have businesses there. And fighters have long been able to come and go across the border of Pakistan, perhaps less in some recent years as they haven't needed to, but there still are many reports that Taliban fighters are able to retreat into Pakistan for medical care, for instance. Disputed to what extent that's a phenomenon, but regardless, you know, the safe haven for the insurgency and for the leadership of the insurgency within Pakistan has been what has enabled the growth of the insurgency and the success of the insurgency more than any other external factor.
And can we just be clear before we come on a bit later to why this support has been forthcoming? Is that support a continuous factor no matter who is actually, let's say, the Prime Minister of Pakistan?
Yes, that support is a continuous factor in part because the element of the Pakistani government and establishment that controls Afghanistan policy is not the civilian leadership, but is the military and military intelligence establishment. And that has an institutional consistency and a policy consistency throughout different civilian administrations and military civilian leadership administrations.
Now, Ahmed Rashid, it's not just Pakistan, is it?
No, it isn't. Certainly, other countries have fallen into line to help out the Taliban, not on a general basis. But for example, Iran has been noted as helping the Taliban with money and maintaining bank accounts and arms. But Iran does not arm everyone. It arms specifically those Taliban who are operating in the west of the country along the border with Iran. So, and Iran is keen to have a friendly border. They're not trying to repeat the 1990s and arming entire ethnic groups and warlords. Russia has also been involved in helping the Taliban. We don't know exactly what they've been giving, but certainly the suggestion that weapons and money have been coming from the Russians. Again, largely with those groups who are along the border with Central Asia, that is Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan. Russia is the guardian angel of these Central Asian states. And they can't move an inch without first clearing policy with Russia. And part of that policy has been to provide the Taliban with weapons. And then, of course, there are the Arab states. I think one of the biggest facilities that the Taliban have is that they're able to import supplies into Pakistan, which are then trucked up to the border and then sent into Afghanistan. Pakistan has no need to actually supply them themselves with weapons and stuff. They can buy it on the market in the Gulf, and they can import it freely.
Ashley Jackson, Ahmed just mentioned the Gulf there and the Gulf states. Can we talk about their support for the Taliban? Does that exist to any significant extent?
Yes, it does. And we could talk for, you know, another half an hour about that alone. But what I would highlight and what often gets missed out is the role of Qatar. And I think, you know, Doha has hosted the Taliban Political Commission for almost a decade. And that address, you know, having an external address with the safety of that government support has allowed the Taliban a platform. Not only have they used it to meet diplomats, open up channels of dialogue around peace, around humanitarian access, but they've used it as a loudspeaker. You know, this is where the world meets the Taliban and sees the political face of the Taliban, at least, and where they're able to sort of use that platform to seek international legitimacy, to spin propaganda, to, you know, have those kinds of representations, which has had an enormous benefit for the Taliban in terms of, again, its propaganda, also its ability to cultivate alliances. The Taliban does not want to be a pariah state as it was in the 1990s. So being able to have this presence has been instrumental in presenting themselves as this kind of state in waiting, which is what they want to be seen as.
Now, let's talk about the motivations here. Laurel Miller first. Pakistan was one of only three countries, I think, in the world to recognise the Taliban government back in the day. Why did the governments, those governments that did recognise the Taliban and that do support the Taliban, support them, given that there must be some disbenefits to having a regime like that on your border?
Yes, there certainly are. But from Pakistan's perspective, the goal here is to have a vector for influence in Afghanistan, its neighboring country, and to have a group in charge in Afghanistan that is friendly to Pakistan and not inclined to be friendly to Pakistan's arch enemy, India. That is a pretty fundamental part of the reasoning on the Pakistani side. Over the last 20 years, it's also the case that Pakistan just didn't believe in what the US and NATO were trying to achieve in Afghanistan. I mean, of course, I think Pakistani officials recognize that if the US and NATO had truly succeeded, then perhaps Pakistan would have benefited. But I think they didn't expect that the endeavor in Afghanistan to set up a new democratic government actually would succeed. And I think they probably had some doubts that such a government would be as friendly to Pakistani interests as they would hope. I mean, there's been a fraught relationship between the governments of Afghanistan over the last 20 years and Pakistan. And so there are two ways to look at this. You could say Pakistan kept up its ties with the Taliban because it was hedging its bets, hedging against the possibility that US and NATO would fail to set up a durable government in Afghanistan. Or you could say they weren't just hedging their bets, they were ensuring the failure of the US and NATO goals because they were continuing to support the antagonists there. It's a matter of some debate where exactly Pakistani views lie, but it's somewhere on that spectrum.
Ashley Jackson, Pakistan is only one of the very powerful regional actors. We talked about how Iran and Russia have used support for the Taliban along their own borders and their areas of interest. But what are the other big power interests outside the United States in Afghanistan?
I mean, there are many. Afghanistan has the unfortunate sort of geographic curse to be at a crossroads of all of these countries who then use, you know, Afghan soil to play out these proxy battles, whether it's Russia and China. We've just talked about Pakistan. We've talked about the Gulf states. And so I think, you know, what you see is that all of these forces converge or are able to converge in Afghanistan because the government has been so weak over the past few decades, even prior to 2001, even prior to the Taliban even existing. You've just had a country that cannot defend itself from all of this regional meddling. And I think that's really the problem, is that, you know, you haven't had a strong government. None of these neighboring countries, by the way, want a strong Afghanistan who can be truly autonomous, who can truly kind of fend off these advances, or at least, you know, cultivate beneficial alliances. But part of the problem is that Afghan leaders have also relied on patronage. Currently, the Afghan government, its budget, 80% of it is international aid. But that, in some way, shape, or form, has been kind of the story for decades upon decades. Financial resources, protection, etc., are required from one regional power or another. And that has left Afghanistan vulnerable to these kinds of proxy conflicts, to continued weakening, to continued conflict.
Ahmed Rashid, one of the things that we've been talking about a lot on the briefing room recently is China's resurgence as a world power. And China is incredibly powerful now and very close to Afghanistan. What do we know about China's view about the Taliban?
Well, the Chinese have become very, very cautious. About 3 years ago, Pakistan persuaded the Chinese to help them launch a peace initiative between the Kabul government and the Taliban. And unfortunately, that fizzled out. But the Chinese, I think, after that, made a decision not to get involved with the politics of peace building in Afghanistan. It was too much for them. So they've avoided the issue. What they're really after, of course, are the minerals. China is the only country that has actually signed deals with the Afghan government for exploration and exploitation of minerals, which China is very keen to get.
What about the situation with the Uyghurs? We also did a program about the repression of the Uyghurs in China. Have they had any worries about the Taliban in that regard?
Well, they certainly seem to have, because just a couple of weeks ago, the Chinese foreign minister met with the Taliban delegation, the highest level of any kind of meeting over many years. And the foreign minister said absolutely clearly that we trust that you will not promote the Uyghurs and that you will not allow them to get training and arms, etc. And the Taliban delegation, which included the deputy leader, said, yes, we will not interfere with the Uyghurs. What are they going to do with the Uyghurs that are already based in Afghanistan? Are they going to shoot them? Are they going to put them in jail? You know, they have given no indication of how they're going to deal with them.
Ashley Jackson, one thing that has been raised many, many times is that the possibility of a Taliban victory would also be a victory for jihadi groups and groups like Al-Qaeda. Now, to what extent so far have we seen those groups existing in the fighting? And how does Al-Qaeda fit into all this?
Well, there are conflicting reports and highly politicized reports about, you know, the Taliban's alliances with what remains of Al-Qaeda, as well as other groups, Al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent, but also the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, various other Islamist groups, let's say. Now, what I've seen and what I've done into research into is the Al-Qaeda angle. And the concern there is really not about right now. It's about the future. Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, best estimates, you probably have a couple of hundred fighters, ex-fighters who are associated with Al-Qaeda. And they aren't doing much on Afghan soil right now. Airstrikes and the U.S. war on terror have really decimated the Al-Qaeda leadership. The question is, if the Taliban takes power, what are they going to do about that? Is it going to be seen as this kind of victory against the war on terror? Is it going to be a magnet for foreign fighters? Is it going to help Al-Qaeda market, for lack of a better term, and rebuild? The Taliban, for its part, has played both sides against the middle. It signed an agreement with the United States in Doha that pledged not to allow Afghan soil to be used for attacks against the U.S. or its allies. That is an incredibly vaguely worded statement about them not taking any specific action, right? They're not renouncing Al-Qaeda. They're not expelling Al-Qaeda. They're just going to be held responsible if anything happens. And I suspect that's probably the best deal that the United States could get in its rush for the exit. And it allows the Taliban to wink and nod to Al-Qaeda or others, you know, look, we're just doing this to get the troops out. And in fact, Al-Qaeda released a statement saying essentially that this was a victory. They endorsed the deal. They couldn't be happier almost. I'm paraphrasing, of course.
Ahmed Rashid, one of the things which we've also seen in the region is that Al-Qaeda is by no means the only armed, what we might call jihadi group. There are others. Can you tell us a bit about those and their interlinking with the Taliban?
Yes, I think those other groups are really very important because what we've been hearing in this offensive, even there have been a large number of Pakistani militants. There are 6 or 7 Pakistani militant groups who are very active in Pakistan, trying to undermine the government and the military. And many of them have come to Afghanistan to fight for the Taliban and taking part in this offensive. Similarly, as Ashley mentioned, there are many groups in Central Asia also, which include the Uyghurs and the Uzbeks and Tajiks, and even now the Kyrgyz. Some of the most peaceful ethnic groups in Central Asia are now turning out militants. And some of them certainly have been fighting alongside the Taliban. So this has become a very big issue. And, you know, when China says, you know, look, don't let the Uyghurs do anything, it's a much bigger problem, I think, than the Uyghurs. It's a problem for Pakistan, China, even Iran, where, you know, Sunni militants have been involved in guerrilla operations against the Shia state. And those Sunni Iranians have been helped by the Taliban and by Al-Qaeda at some points in time.
Now, we've heard significant fears about the consequences of Taliban advances being significant refugee movements and also the things that we've been talking about in terms of terror. If the Taliban do essentially take over most of Afghanistan and Kabul, is there any way they can be got rid of again?
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that running an insurgency is cheaper and easier than managing a government. And so, you know, the successes that we have seen from the Taliban in achieving their goals so far do not necessarily signify what is ahead for them in terms of internal challenges within their movement and the challenges of trying to control and manage Afghanistan. So I think there's a lot of uncertainty ahead. I don't see any external powers displacing the Taliban again. I mean, barring something as dramatic as 9/11, I think they've probably learned a lesson not to enable that sort of dramatic event again, given what happened to them the last time when the U.S. invaded. And I think that we will see at least the regional countries, at least Pakistan, Iran, China, Russia, and the Central Asians trying to work with the Taliban if they do come to power and find a way to at least moderate how they behave in their foreign policy, though they probably, these countries won't be too fussy about Taliban domestic policy, whether the U.S. and Western powers can work with a Taliban-dominated government is much more questionable. But I do think that there will be some consideration of that question, whether there is a way to go with the grain of Taliban ascendance rather than trying to work against it and see if there are ways to modify their behavior and make them a sort of tolerable regime. But we'll have to see. That, as I said, a lot of challenges ahead, not only for these other governments, for, of course, the Afghan people who are the greatest victims of everything that we've been talking about today, but also challenges for the Taliban, too, in fully realizing their objectives.
Laurel Miller there with Ashley Jackson and Ahmed Rashid. My thanks to them and also to Ali Latifi. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirstine Knight and Sally Abrahams. The sound was mixed by James Beard and the editor is Penny Murphy. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might like other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. Recently, we've asked where have all the workers gone in the UK? How much will COP26 help tackle climate change? And could tensions over Taiwan and who it belongs to lead to war?
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parris. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.